Clubhouse.
This is Caroline.
This is Paul.
And this is Mike. Welcome to the Third Day Podcast. Tonight we're talking about Sunday the Ghost, episode 3 of The Summer.
So, Caroline, what did you think?
were you shocked and awed, Caroline, at how the episode ended up?
Yeah, boys, I pooped my pants.
Is it because of the loose bowels you have?
Loose stools.
Yeah.
Oh my God. You guys, this was shocking. I was like, honestly, here's how I felt. You know the gif of Chrissy Teigen at like the awards show and she's making that face that's like, yeah, like the whole time? That was, yes, my face for like 90% of this episode. I was like, just completely like, oh no. Like nothing was like completely shocking and surprising, but everything was like, you know, skin crawly, like, oh fuck.
Well, so much happened. I mean, if you were to like list off the plot points of this episode,
which we will,
I mean, so much happened from the beginning to the end, all the twists and turns, the people he could trust, the people he thought he could trust, and how it all fell apart on him. That, I mean, the deck was stacked against him from the time he got on the island, from even before he got on the island years ago. Mm-hmm. All that stuff. It just felt like a tsunami of things working against poor Sam here.
He couldn't even trust himself in the end, right? I mean, he ends up doing the thing that he kind of is swearing that he won't do the entire time and ends up doing it. But he was never going to go Sam's way. He was not even realizing they were playing chess, you know, when chess was being played. I wasn't shocked by the episode. I actually thought it made a lot of sense. I thought they led us there really well. And I'm happy with the amount of answers that they gave. They really concluded this story, which is not something you get often. So many people complain about finales. And this is a finale of sorts, like a mini finale. What happened to this? What happened to that? You know, we don't know where these people go. And sometimes it's fine. Sometimes you like not knowing. But here, I thought they gave a really complete story. I thought they answered a lot of the questions.
I agree with that. They did answer a lot of questions. And they answered them in ways that didn't feel concocted at the last second. Like, it wasn't just like, oh my God, where did that come from? Like, it really did feel like they had laid the groundwork for us.
They really did. They put the work in. Nothing here was like, and then it was, you know, it was a ghost all along. You know, it was never that at any point. You could all track it back and where they laid the steps out.
There was one element that I've watched this like 2 or 3 times, and it's still...
Humble brag.
I was just going to say, wow, like put your dick back in your pants, Paul.
Jesus, it just punched me in the face. Jesus, wow.
Maybe it's just I don't have an appreciation for English people, English country people, or what. But This amounted to a religious war or a civil war on OC between the people that thought that going with Nathan, I guess, as their next Messiah was the way to go, or the people that were wanted Sam. And it seemed like this was a very civil war, because otherwise it seemed like there was a lot at stake for them. You know, the kind of the prosperity of the island and the people there was tied into who led the island in their minds. And I guess there were a couple different things. There was the existing Charrington, and which a lot of people didn't agree on.
Colonel Sanders.
Well,
Colonel
and he
Sanders.
Wanted to be done. Let's and be clear. He was done, done right? with the job.
He wanted to retire permanently.
Right.
And then there were the various...
I wanted to go see Margaret's answer, man.
And then there were the various Sam and Nathan options. And these things seemed so serious that they would go through all this trouble to have all these things go on. You know, the festival, which kind of seems like a put on at this point, and all this stuff, and the way that they didn't take to like shooting each other or having things really go nuts was curious to me. Like at the end, when there was the resolution, they were like, you know, just to shake hands and let bygones be bygones. We've got our Messiah. And that just was like, I guess I'm used to seeing people with their hands around their throats.
I disagree a little bit on the part where you say things didn't go completely nuts. I mean, come on now. Well, I mean, Larry. I mean,
if you're Sam, things went completely nuts. But I mean, just Joe Island Dweller.
Yeah, but
didn't have to like take his rake out into the street and call shenanigans on the whole thing.
But they were
thing.
Going to like kill the guy who they felt was the opposition's choice.
Yeah, but they had a reason for that, though, right? I mean, they felt he was going to be. It was kind of what Mrs. It was what Mrs. Martin's whole arc was in this episode, the self-contained arc that she had in this episode, where she went from "You should be the father. Everyone wants you to be the father." Epona died. She killed herself because she wanted you to be the father. You know, to the point where then he rails against the island and their beliefs in the gods, and then she's like, "Oh, fucking weasel! Like, you could never lead us. You can't be the father. You're just such a heretic." And then so she comes around to the idea that she's gonna have to kill him because now he's an impediment. You know, it's kind of a "you're either with us or against us" kind of thing. And I think they all would have been happy with Sam being the father if he was so inclined to take the role. But following Mr. Martin's line of logic, and obviously the Martins hold a lot of sway on the island, right? They are the man in black and Jacob on the island in Lost, right? They're the yin and yang controlling the pieces and kind of telling people what to think. And Mr. Martin's idea of "don't even approach Sam, because what adult male, what adult in male or female is going to accept there's this island and you're destined to be the father of it. It's also the soul of the world. So we need you to kind of move here and take care of all of us." Cool? Cool.
It's got a sweet house as part of the deal.
Yeah, it's got a big house, and we call it the big house. It comes with a chef. He makes you fresh tartare right at the table. You know, they're going to throw blood and wine and maybe some feces at you. Like, it's a whole party. You know, who would turn that down? You know, so you could see where they're like, let's just bypass him and go right for the son. But I think he is the optimal leader, right? They don't have to have a regent in place for Nathan. You know, you have a grown-ass man who is going to be able to kind of hit the ground running and doing things for the island. So I think they're all on board with Sam being the leader. I think they just had kind of developed this idea that he wasn't going to play ball.
So. Okay.
So satisfaction-wise, like 1 to 5, what would you guys give this now that the twist is revealed? Are you satisfied with the logic of the show? Was it fair? Did you guys feel like it was well done?
Satisfaction with the logic of the show? Yes. I mean, at the end of it, nothing about it didn't make sense. And even though when they got on that boat, you could see kind of where things were going at that point, even the Jess betrayal.
Yeah.
But still, the Nathan being alive was still kind of iffy, even though they had told him that. And we still never saw his face. So there's still a little bit of mystery there, but there's still a little show left. I think the logic all worked out. I think there are viewers that will be lost. I hope they listen to the podcast so we can explain it to them.
Yeah.
How things worked
out.
We'll
just guide them a little.
Because the pieces are there for it all to click together. It's just, like I said before, this third episode had a ton of stuff that happened.
No, it's a lot to unpack. And it wasn't a supersized episode. It was still just a, you know, 52-minute, 54. It was an under an hour episode, and they did a lot of stuff with it. I wanted to call back, actually, to something that Caroline said either last week. I think it was last week. I had made a comment that, you know, the island seems to be either not Team Sam or Team Sam. And you had said, no one on this island is Team Sam. The island is split. There are two different factions here, but no one's actually looking out for Sam. And you were 100% correct. I was over and over again. That thought came to me this episode. No one here really cares about Sam for Sam's sake. They're not asking, you know, are you going to move your wife and your two surviving children here? Your two other children, I guess, because his son is alive. You know, like, that never comes up. His happiness never comes up. It's all what Sam can do for us in the island. So at the end of the day, that's a very sad thing. The idea that Sam has to now fill this role, and because of his joy at his son, at least initially anyway, the joy of having his son back, he's going to capitulate and play ball and become the father. But this is not about his happiness in any kind of way. No one was on Team Sam, not even Jess, at the end of the episode.
Mr. Martin was sort of, he was leaning towards Sam at a certain point.
But you think for the good of Sam?
No.
He never wanted him to get off the island. No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, no. Like,
that was my point to Mike, was that there was no one who was thinking, what is the right thing for Sam? Where should he live?
Let's try and get him off the island, right? That I guess that's the best way to express it. At no point, even a guy who's going to take the boat, clearly, because you could tell by the way he was hemming and hawing and then, then he's kind of like, ah, Sam, come on, Sam, don't do it, Sam. You know, you got to stay. And then he gets, you know, pushed in the water, you know, via Candillas. They were never going to let him be off the island. So I think that's the best expression of, even if you like Sam, and I think Mr. Martin definitely likes Sam. I think Jess actually really liked Sam. None of them were for Sam. They were not for Scuba. They were not for Sam.
Agreed.
I think for Scuba is a Along Came Polly reference. I think I just threw in there.
So I asked you guys, on a scale of 1 to 5, what was your satisfaction level?
Oh, I'd rank it at 5 for myself. I mean, if I was recommending the show to someone else, I think it would be kind of a case by case whether I thought they had it to make it through that show and get it, if I would give them the same number.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you'd have to have the podcast companion piece.
Right. Of course. Obviously, like, that goes without saying. It's like Slow Cousin Earl or something. I might be like, well, this is more of a 3 for you. I don't think it's for you, Earl.
Yeah. This is a show where you need to know the person's like TV bona fides. You know, did you watch Lost? Are you into serial dramas? Can you watch a show without looking at your phone? Because you have to pay attention.
Did you think they were all dead at the end of Lost? Oh, you do. Right. Never mind.
Right. Did you think they were dead the whole time? Because they weren't. Did you have a fundamental misunderstanding of the finale of Lost? What did you get on your SATs? I'll give it a 5 for me also, because it made a lot of sense to me. I was really happy with it. It had a great narrative story, but it was also wasn't super predictable. I think they could have gone a lot of ways at the end, and I would have thought several of them would have totally made sense. It wasn't predictable, but it made sense to me once it was all kind of unfolded.
I agree. I give it a 5 because I also enjoyed the fact that they had these little nuggets all along the way, and that they wove in all the mythology and all of the religious aspects that you could actually go back and they were using correct terms, or they were using names that should give you some information. And those types of things, I always feel like, all right, someone thought this out. You know, they knew the ending they wanted to get to, and they wove a little tale here, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun ride.
Now that we have a set decorator friend, did you look at anything in the show? I'm thinking of like the little chapel in particular, mm-hmm. with the quality of the work that went into the scary art around the thing, mm-hmm. and how well it fit into the old chapel that must be wherever they shot. They didn't build a chapel for this, but they did replace the art. I'm sure they didn't find some sort of like satanic
or like a Jude Law saint on the thing.
Right.
That they had to go find that first and then do the casting.
I mean, luckily Jude Law happened to have that painting handy. He had it done years ago.
Right. He had some stuff done when they made him Pope.
Right. Exactly. Right.
Exactly.
Now give me Dark Pope. Give me a Dark Pope painting. That's like Lamb of God? No, fucking cut the Lamb of God. That's right. What we want. Yeah. Carve up that lamb. Yeah, I mean, that church scene was fantastic. I think I came in my pants during the Mimir scene and his little hut and all the details last week. The church, I could not have stopped it frame by frame anymore if I wanted to. And like looking up, like Googling, like picture motifs and religious art motifs. The use of like the halos and stuff, it was so well done, because that's exactly the style of religious art in churches that have those kinds of things, just with this kind of really dark satanic twist on it. It was fantastic.
It's like they're usually pretty hard on Jesus in these things, but everyone else is okay normally. But
yeah, I mean, and even the tapestry that's kind of hanging behind Opponent's body, but it's done in such a way where it almost like looks like it's touching her, because it's an island, right? So you have like the villagers in the boat getting swept over the side as a wave crests, and then there's just like a trail of bones kind of descending down through the water. What a fantastic detail! Like, there's no reason they had to do that. The scene could have been just as powerful just by having the dead girl on the altar. They didn't need any of the extras, but they went there, and I really appreciated it.
Right. Like, the production designer saw the dead girl bleeding out on the altar and was like, let's go further.
Yeah. Not enough.
We appreciate that set decorator hard.
We definitely do.
Yeah.
I stan set decorators.
I mean, you're a semi-expert at this point, so.
Just semi. Hard on the semi.
Well, you know, somebody gets the job done sometimes. I like that some of the callbacks made sense. So there was, you know, last week we kind of took Jason apart and his truthfulness, a part where he holds the gun and he kind of has that breakdown and he says, you know, I lost a child because of you. And we all sat here and we were like, you're full of shit. There was no combine at killing, you know, you're talking about Epona and, you know, and that whole thing. And how could that be because of Sam? Well, they did kill his son because it was the same age as Nathan. And it's a body stand-in, as we learned. And so he really did. And it was all to get Sam to come to the island in the end, you know, putting him through that loss so that he would be hanging out in those woods.
It was their shit plan that fell apart.
Yeah,
they got the wrong Gul'tan to work on their behalf.
That's exactly, as Mr. Martin tells it, that was the problem. Is Gul'tan was the big weak link.
Right. Yeah. There's like, any volunteers to go abduct a boy? And Gul'tan's like, oh. He's like horseshacking.
Yeah. Oh. Mr. Martin. I can do it, Mr. Martin.
That's a bad sign.
Yeah.
Mr. Martin.
You probably shouldn't have chosen him.
Do you suppose that Mr. Martin and his belief that was the plan to go with is why Mrs. Martin calls him shithead and shit for brains and fuckhead and all that kind of stuff? Like, do you think she's been doing that for the last 8 years or however long Nathan's been gone?
Calm the fuck down, fucko. First, let's talk about Mrs. Martin. And she has the best vocabulary ever. That calm the fuck down, fucko. I have used that at least 3 times since watching this episode.
Really?
Yeah. I had a client meeting today that did not end well because of that. But that's fine. That's a separate item. But
right. You won't bill for that last half.
No,
hour, right?
No. They're gonna get that call for free today. But... I think so. I think a lot of her anger towards him, I think all of her like kind of passive aggressive and not so passive aggressive like attitude towards him is, you kind of shit the bed on this. You know, you did not hand it, you know, we should not have left the future of the island to your dumbass. I think that's the kind of vibe.
I believe it was all stemming from that.
I agree. And I think that that's also why he takes it, because it wasn't going well. I mean, he had nothing to refute the fucko status.
Right.
But he does stand up to her, though, which is interesting. This was the first time in the 3 hours that we watched the show. She says something to him as he's walking away back into the jungle, and he comes back. He stops. He turns around. He comes back to her. And he says, I was just trying to talk. It was the first time he's ever kind of stood up to her or pushed back a little bit. And I wonder if now, having confessed to what he did to Sam and kind of getting it out there in the open, maybe he felt like he had purged himself of the guilt a little bit. So he was, you know, all the cards were on the table. He seemed sincere in how bad he felt, I thought. So I wonder if he had kind of like a second wind of a backbone. I've been in the doghouse long enough kind of feeling that he came back and kind of got in her face a little bit.
And it also kind of reached the all or nothing stage.
Yeah, I was going to say we were at the climax. Like, there wasn't, I mean, this isn't going to happen or not happen at this point. There's no reason to keep niggling him, right? Like, it's done. He's here. Let's do this.
Let's talk about the opening scene a little bit, because there was some stuff here, I think, that made a lot of sense, you know, as we learned about what had happened, what the baptism represented in becoming the father of the island. But there was some shit in there, some symbolism in there, some stuff happening in there that I just could not parse. I used all of my kind of Catholic schooling. I used Google, and there was some stuff I just could not figure out. Let's start with the baby, the invisible crying baby in the old-fashioned pram. Other than giving me a real Rosemary's Baby vibe, I could not figure out what that meant or what that represented, the baby crying. What did you guys think about that?
I think that Nathan is their youngest child, and I feel like an empty pram could definitely be the missing baby feeling. And having a baby crying when Sam is like in this state of semi-lucid, and how he goes, no, not the baby. I think there's like that grasping, that like, my baby's been taken kind of feel. That was just the vibe. I don't think it necessarily has to be like exact symbolism there, but I think that it created a vibe of like a where's my baby feel.
Yeah, I kind of had like a Nathan feeling also, like you, Caroline, but I really couldn't figure it out more than that.
I just kept feeling like, as a parent, I mean, what's the thing that would torture you if you couldn't find your child? The thing that would torture you the most is the sound of a crying baby, looking for them. You'd have that sense of like, where are you? And please don't hurt the baby. Whatever you guys are doing over there, there's a baby crying somewhere. Please don't hurt the baby. Makes it creepy too. Rosemary's Baby is right on.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple times. I feel like this is the second time that I've brought up Rosemary's Baby and watching this. Rosemary's Baby remains for me, other than The Exorcist, probably is like the scariest movie I've ever seen. It's scary in an unnerving sense. I remember seeing it. I was just like 13 or 14 or 15. I was like an early teenager when I saw it, and it just kind of always stuck with me. And it, so for me, it stands in as a still terrifying movie. And there were a couple vibes in this and that.
Well, in this case, the way that he describes Nathan, It sounds like he was going through a little bit of a phase when they, you know, left each other's company, where depending on how he was nurtured at that point, he could become a destructive little guy or become a normal person if he's, you know, shown that we don't tease insects and then that kind of stuff.
But that does make you, I mean, Rosemary's Baby, for those of you who don't want you to completely spoil it, but a Devil Baby is... Yeah,
that movie's older than all of us.
The thinking, though, of like, is it possible that Nathan is like a bad seed? I mean, that came to light here. Is he a bad seed? And, you know, that is a big question mark. Of
the Charrington line might be, you know...
Messy at best.
Well, I'm thinking not very messy is the thing. Kind of a direct line.
If you more know. more of a telephone pole with, you know, no branches.
Understood.
Right.
Yes.
Understood.
That's interesting because I definitely had the thought ever since he was telling Jess about how he had started to become kind of cruel. That was an interesting thing, especially with all of the dead crickets and stuff and on the island and all the death that we kind of see on the island. Like, massacring animals, small little animals and creatures. I mean, that's classic bad kid stuff, right? That's a TV and movie trope. Like, oh, that kid's gone. That kid's broken bad. He's ripping the wings off of little animals. That was definitely a Nathan vibe. Do you think it was Nathan, like real alive Nathan we were seeing all over the island these three episodes, kind of acting as a guide for Sam, like we had been saying? Or was it just the image of Nathan that was kind of leading Sam around the island and more of like a manifestation of like Sam's imagination?
That is a big question because I kind of think it's both. I don't really have any like, well, this was a ghost and this was really the kid. I don't have a roadmap for you. I go back to like on the mainland where there was the curly headed boy that tied off Epona's rope. That was definitely there tying off the rope, but can't be accounted for in actual, you know,
like, how did he get back to the island?
Right, stuff all
like that.
Right. And then there's the Sam being various levels of hurt or intoxicated or inebriated or whatever the right ebriated is. Mm-hmm. And chasing the boy around the island. When you're describing the little sacrifices around the island, then I'm thinking, holy shit, Nathan kill all those little animals and just leave their little altars all over the island?
He's doing some practicing. Him and Mimir, they were doing some, you know, basic biology.
I'm glad to see
education is alive on OC. You know, they're teaching skills, so that's good.
Well, that's, I guess, my answer is that I guess it's both.
I could see the concept of both, especially from the standpoint of if you take him as more of a symbol and not necessarily like an apparition or even, you know, an actual, not necessarily an avatar or anything else. But if you think about like, so with Epona and you're talking about tying off the rope, the family line was her motivation to do what she was doing. So the idea that she was pushed and or assisted by the boy to get to that point, we may have seen that acted out, but I think we're supposed to take that as more like she was like emotionally and however else you want to say it, intellectually pushed to go do this by this line, this family line needing to come back, right? Mm. So there was like an acting out of it visually for us, but it may not have ever been either the boy there nor a ghost, but more just like representative of the reasoning behind why she was doing
I view this as a paranormal story, though. Like, there's a supernatural element to it. It's not as straightforward. These people just believe crazy shit, but there's no crazy shit. I don't believe that. I think it's...
But there is a line that Jess said that I think is important. When she says the line, it's not about belief. It just is. It just is the truth. It is like law, right?
Yeah.
So it's not the belief in whether that boy is there or not. It just is. That boy and that family line was the motivation for what she was doing. So you don't have to believe whether he was there or not. It just is.
I want to give us some props while we're just talking about Epona right here, because I think we were dead on about her making a sacrifice of herself for the island to appease the island gods. And while not having a father there or trying to get the island to be less pissed off at it because Colonel Sanders was doing such a bad job in his later years... You know, being a sacrifice to the island, which is what we were talking about with the hanging, the drowning, the on fire last week. you know, I think her hanging, I think it was her making a sacrifice. And then when he rejected the whole being the father thing, Sam did, you know, the way Miss Martin explains it, that she went and killed herself on the altar again as a sacrifice, like as like almost like a Band-Aid to keep the island from completely fucking these people, you know, while the whole father situation got sorted out. So I think we deserve some like pretty good symbolic props for nailing that.
Well, I agree. I also think that Epona's job there was to continually push Sam in the direction of owning up to his lineage here.
All the women were.
And so when you look at the hanging, that was like, you know, her best attempt to get him there. She did that part. And when he wouldn't just do it, I don't know necessarily that she was sacrificing herself for the island in the woods or that on the altar it was for the island in the sense of like how we were kind of thinking of the island having a soul and that kind of business, but more like for the island, like for the community. I need him to stay and I need to make such a gesture to Sam himself that he will be so overwhelmed that he will be driven to want to see his son. Because that's really what happens from that moment. He gets like this extra fire in his belly to see Nathan.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And that's like really what like leads the whole thing.
It's been bothering me. It was bothering me at the end of last episode when she kisses him and says she's sorry. I think I even asked you guys last week, like, what did she mean by that? Now watching how it played out with her in this episode and her killing herself on the altar, does that change what that meant? What was that sorry? Was that like, I'm sorry, I was complicit in you coming here at all? I'm sorry that you're not going to see me again. What was that whole end of episode two about in light of how it played out?
In review, I thought that was, I'm sorry that I'm going to have to put you through this. That's what I saw. Like, yeah. not that, because he was already involved. There's no uninvolving. It's right, just, right. It's just now that it has to go this way.
Yeah. And the same way kind of Jess was, right? I mean, Jess was kind of apologetic of the role she played. But because of her daughters, she had to play that role. It was interesting. You had these two women, girl and woman, acting how maybe they didn't want to act, but doing it for the greater good of the island or because they believe in the island and its people or because they were being forced to, but not being happy about it, not really acting of their own free will as they kind of pushed and cajoled Sam in one particular direction.
Well, and honestly, I mean, everybody had that ultimate motivation. Everyone felt like they were a marionette at the end of the day. Like, I don't feel like there was anyone who was in this entire show that felt like they were working of their own motivation for their own reasons. And they were all like straightforward. It was all like, I have to do it this way because I have to do it like this.
I disagree with the exception of one person at the end of the day.
You agree except for the one person at the end of the day?
I think there's one person who was not acting in pursuit of the island's agenda as it relates to Sam at the end of the day. Jason, Epona's father. In the end of the day, when you look back on his actions on the island, they were completely driven by the sacrifice and loss of his children because of Sam and Sam needing to be on the island. All of his actions were kind of driven. Why he shows up fired and pissed off at Sam. We were wondering that in episode one. Why is this guy so mad at Sam? Like, he saved his daughter. Well, it's because of him that his daughter had to go out into the woods and hang herself to begin with. Why does he hold a gun to him in the last episodes? Because his son had a stand-in for his son as a sacrifice, you know,
right,
to bring
him
to the island.
But to clean up what I just said, but that's the thing. Jason didn't wake up one morning and decide to fight one way or the other. His strings were pulled. People fucked with his son. People took his son away and made him a stand-in for Nathan. People told Epona, I think Mr. Martin, go in the woods and go do these things. So what I'm trying to say is I don't think there's any single person that wasn't being yanked by someone else
because
of what was happening. You know, no one woke up with a belief that made them go
right.
Do XYZ. It was actually being pulled on by other people.
I think the point I was making was everyone on the island was acting, was I agree with you, was being yanked and pulled, but all except for Jason were yanking and pulling in order to make Sam the father of the island. I think Jason was not in on that. I don't think Jason gave a fuck about that agenda. I think he was just acting out of grief for his kids. And then you have that scene at the end where he says, get off the island, get to the mainland, call the police.
What do we think about that, though? Damn.
Yeah, I mean, he's done with the island, but conspiracy theory would say, well, he wants to drive him towards the beach so that he'll get on the boat, so the boat will take him around the bend to the big house. But I didn't take it that way, because I feel like he was standing off to the side from everyone else on the island, agenda-wise. I think he was had had enough. I think he had kind of had enough of the island and its politics. Remember, he's the one railing and day drinking on the beach, talking about the cunts in the big house. You know, Jason is not down with Team Colonel Sanders in any way, shape, or form.
You know, if you look at it in from that perspective, the tent revival scene where he is pretty nude on his knees before the
being punished, yeah,
the priest, then that, you know, normally when we think of tent revivals and we see people up with the preacher, we're thinking of people that have come for healing or absolution or something, and they have volunteered themselves to come to the front of the church. Now I'm looking at it like, no, he was dragged there and he was made to participate.
Yeah, Colonel Sanders was making an example of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was not a I'm trying to cleanse your sins away for your own good. It was a punishment. It was, you have tried to fuck this island and enough of you.
Interesting how that can turn like that.
I think that your initial call, Paul, when we were talking from the very first episode, that almost every single scene and almost every single thing that someone said, specifically Islanders, had like double meanings, how you could take it one way, but given a little bit more information, you were going to look back and watch it and see it a completely different way.
Yeah.
And I think that you just said that, like, you, when you really think about it, that scene played out one way to you the first time and a completely different way when you got a little more information.
I was thinking of the scene where Sam's trying to get off the island and they find that truck parked behind his car. And Mr. Martin is like, well, I'm not sure where the owner is. And Sam's like, I have to get the fuck off this island. And there was a very dramatic way that Mr. Martin's face drops. It wasn't just like he quit smiling. It was like it washed over his face.
Right. Well, it was because Sam went from like 0 to 60, like the way he like screamed at him and used like fuck and everything.
Yeah.
That was the first time he had been so adamant.
But also that attitude mirrors kind of what he says later about their beliefs being shit and all that kind of stuff, in a way that he's not informed enough to know that stuff yet, but it's still sort of that same part of his heart and soul that's saying it, I think. You know, Mr. Martin more or less said that the idea of getting him on the island in the first place was too far-fetched, and that's why they went with the Nathan abduction. But the fact that he was here now kind of turn Mr. Martin's thinking around a little bit. Then to hear him say that he desperately wants to leave and he's kind of getting at least verbally violent about it, puts a new spin on the scene once you get the whole story.
We touched on it briefly, but we didn't actually circle the drain on it. And I think a lot of people are going to ask, so I want to ask you guys, now that we've heard the story, we heard the story from Mr. Martin's point of view anyway, of what happened with Nathan and bringing him to the island and Goltan. Did Sam kill Goltan? Did the Islanders kill Goltan? Did they lock him in his little trailer and burn him alive? And if so, why would Sam have that kind of memory vision of being there kind of at the fire? Now knowing how the story played out, is our original theory, right? Because we were kind of kicking around last week that Sam, you know, maybe in a fugue state, and maybe the reason he was familiar with the island was because he had tracked Goltan there and killed him, or killed him somewhere and dragged him to the island. Sam killed Goltan on the island at some point and just didn't remember it in some kind of episodic amnesia state. I don't remember. Was that the term, episodic amnesia?
Episodic psychosis? Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, in some kind of state. Like, does that still hold water? Or hearing how Goltan kind of fucked the plan, did the Islanders, you know, deal with Goltan on their own?
I think both are plausible. I lean toward he did it and doesn't remember it. But you could probably make a strong argument in the same way that he is seeing ghost Nathans everywhere around the island and seeing himself in Epona's shirt and all that kind of stuff. You can make an argument that he's being fed visions from somewhere, and that seeing the trailer burning and all that kind of stuff is another example of that. But I personally believe, maybe it's just because I'm a father and would like to think that I would burn the fucker too, that he did the burning and just doesn't know it.
That was my feeling too. It's more cathartic to think that he did it and doesn't remember it. What do you think, Caroline?
The more that I'm listening and thinking, I actually think probably the Mr. Martin crew did it, whether it was Larry, Mr. Cement Shoes, or Mr. Martin himself, whatever. I think they do have such a strong belief in sacrificing a human person for misdeeds or things gone wrong or things that pay for your sins that I actually feel pretty much that they did it.
But he didn't actually kill Nathan.
Right.
Well, I think your theory that the island, I remember, they have the Trinity, right, on the island. We learned from Amir and Jess last week about the Trinity of Isis. And there was the god, Tutades, who believed in sacrifice via birding. So I think that is strong evidence that the islanders would make an offering to the island, right? Because the island is falling apart on them. They don't have a new father. Colonel Sanders is not getting the job done anymore. So they're sacrificing to try and appease the island because that's what they believe. And so the idea of Goltan is as good as anyone if we have to sacrifice someone. So them burning him alive kind of fits in that narrative.
It feels that way. But I agree with you in the double talk whole theme. It also feels right that Sam did it. You know, right. It feels equally right.
Yeah, I think either of them is very plausible. And I think why would Sam have visions? You know, the same way Sam is familiar with the island,
Yeah. Even
if the islanders kill Goltan, is because, I mean, Sam is a part of this island. He is of the Charrington line. So if you buy into the conceit of the show, the way the islanders do, that OC is this supernatural place to some extent, the soul of the world or whatever you want to call it, a world, you know, axis point, that the line of the father, capital F, of the island would have some kind of power to see the things or glimpses of visions of things that happen on the island when they're like strong emotion occurrences.
So one thing that I've read about a lot of times over the last like 5 or 10 years is this idea of DNA carrying memories. And it's something that is really interesting to me because there's certain things that I say and do that literally generations of people back, I know the people in between, and they'll say, my mother said that. And that's crazy that you say it like that. There is actual scientific proof that DNA carries memories of, specifically of traumatic stress through generations, and that it's actually encoded in the DNA of subsequent generations. So it is absolutely plausible that Sam could have literal DNA memory of things that happened on the island, which I know seems really weird and hard to understand compared to like our regular memory. But if you're going to bring in Mimir and you're going to bring in the idea of memory and the idea of the island having a memory, I think that you're so right that he's tied into it family wise. And then also I think he just carries that DNA.
Oh, I believe in genetic memory. I think that's a thing. I think there are strong, maybe not physical memory. Like I remember what this thing feels like, but the sense of something, the emotion of something. I think that is a real thing that can be passed down the line in families. And no, that absolutely makes sense to me. You know, again, as a father, like Paul said, like as a father myself, like cathartically, I'd like to think he's the one who did it and didn't remember it. But it seems very plausible to me that the islanders, for a host of reasons, are the ones who did it.
So here's a funny thing. Normally in a show like this, I personally would need to know definitively whether or not Sam did it. And I am having my own little moment because I'm thinking, do you know what? I actually don't mind it either way. It doesn't bother me. Where normally it would bother me a lot. I'm okay with if Sam did it in one of this episodic psychosis issue kind of, you know, lack of memory, because in that case, I kind of almost put him as an islander. In those moments, you know, where
he is an islander, he just didn't realize it.
So he kind of went back to his roots in some way. And so when we say maybe the island did it or whatever, we're actually kind of saying the same thing. And I'm kind of okay with all of it.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think it makes a lot of sense. And honestly, had he been the father at the time and this habit happened, let's say this weirdo living on the island took Nathan, I think Sam, as the father, maybe could have just as easily ordered this thing to be carried out, even if he didn't do it himself. So in some ways, you know, he did it because the island did it, and the island did it because he did it. You know, it's this whole Trinity mushing thing. This father, the son, and the Holy Ghost, or just the ghost kind of thing. Man, I've got so many questions.
Do you want to talk about a couple of things that like kind of stuck out as like a huh? because then that would kind of be like the protocol and like those things.
Yeah, there are definitely a couple of
like, so, why did that happen, right?
Things that didn't make sense. Yeah, so one of the things that didn't make sense to me at the end of the day was, why did he get that call from a day in the field that went nowhere, and then he ends up dropping his phone and breaking his phone? It was kind of like a fun callback to episode one, where we heard a lot about a day and all of his like life troubles, but I didn't really understand like why we needed that. Like, I don't know, save us 30 seconds. I didn't get what that meant. What did you think, Paul?
Man, just the pure mechanical reason of taking the phone out of the pocket in order to lose it and break it seems pretty dumb, because it could be broken just in a fall if it's in his pocket or whatever. So there's no special reason that a call from that particular guy would be the thing. The one thing that it does do is it ties us back to his everyday life, as if we don't have enough reminders anyway that he does have a normal life still going on elsewhere. But that's not a terrific reason either. I'm afraid I'm stumped. What about you, Caroline?
I'm taking it that Ade represents his future. It was all about getting the money to be able to make this future plan. It was this planning commission kind of thing. It was a bribe to expand and do what they wanted to do. So that whole thing represented their future and moving forward. And there was like that last ditch effort of the rest of the world to get in contact with him. This moment, for me, it's like a soul-crushing moment, because it makes me think of this Twilight Zone episode, which I fucking can't stand because it absolutely rips my heart in half. And it's the one where the man is like, knows he's going to have to be in this bunker for the rest of his life, and he has like stockpiled all these books, and all he wants to do is read. And at the very last second, he drops his glasses and steps on them, and he can't see. And
it's my favorite episode all the time in the world.
But it breaks my heart in two. I mean, I know, I understand. But isn't that this moment, Mike? Like, isn't it? He has his future in his hand, and it's there. Like, it's everything that he wants is there, and he drops it, and he kneels on it, and he breaks his own possibility of the future. And it's like, it like rips my heart in half. So I appreciate you loving it, and it's a wonderful twist of the story. Don't get me wrong on that. It's my empathetic heart just feels so bad.
I just meant of a lifetime of watching Twilight Zone marathons on the 4th of July weekend on Channel 11 growing up in New York. Like, that was like how I spent like every 4th of July weekend, was watching Twilight Zone. That episode as a whole always remains like my favorite, like Twilight Zone.
It sticks out. Well, that's very funny, because I did not know that, but it still sticks out to me so much as like, doesn't it feel like that though? It's the all the desperation in the world and thinking you finally have a shot, and then breaking it yourself. You broke your own thing there. You know, it's like,
It's why he went on to become a trainer for Rocky instead of Apollo Creed.
But your point about breaking it right then and there part of the reason Mike might be curious, and you can say if I'm right or wrong, is that he's deaf right then. The phone isn't really that good to him anyway, in terms of like calling and talking to somebody.
You're right, because of the explosion, right? So okay, well, we're all about senses though. Then did he not lose all distant senses, Paul? He can't see, he can't hear.
Yeah.
He can't figure it out.
Even with him not being able to hear, you could see where that phone represents kind of a lifeline to the real world, the way he is still picturing
like
it in his head.
Clinging onto it.
And so looking for like meaning in a thing, like why would they include this? Well, this is what I came up with. The idea of him pulling it out and then breaking it is like literally kind of like the island being like, no, no, no. Like, you're done with the outside world. This is your life now. And because it's all like rapidly downhill from that point on. He runs into Jess right after that. He's on the boat right after that. He's on the dock right after that. And
well,
then, you know,
and
so
you could back it up one like, step and say he saw Epona right before that. Like, all the things that were keeping him remotely sane.
Right.
You know, caring for Epona and all these little moments like are cruelly falling apart in his hands.
Right. No longer can he say, well, how's Epona? She's alive because of you. Like, no more. Like, she is no longer alive and because of you. I think it's just the part of the dominoes falling rapidly here at the end of the episode, of the door closing on his life that he knew. And obviously, the phone didn't really work that well on the island anyway, but the physical breaking of it is a physical kind of manifestation of it, of that being cut away from him now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I think I agree with all that.
Another head scratcher. So at the beginning of the episode, Jess kind of powers out into the ocean and drags his ass back to the island and swims him back, which apparently she is an Olympic swimmer, because that sea was rough, my friends. and then she like drags out like the 40,000 like pounds. Like, why? Where did that come from? What was the point of that? Why bring up the 40,000 pounds again that she found under the bed that morning?
Once you realize that she's in cahoots with everybody, it does seem pretty extraneous to call him on the carpet for his story about the 40K.
Well, I think actually, no. I think when you look back, it's another way of like mind fucking with him, right? Because remember, when he finds that money, he's all looped out of his head, right? He's right, super
how
drunk.
Could he have it, though?
He's super drunk of the debauchery. Right, well, she accuses him. She's like, are you in the middle of another, you know, psychotic episode kind of thing? It's all part of the, you don't really know what's going on. You know, like someone's trying to, like, you know, like swing a watch in front of you while they, like, weave back and forth trying to, like, disorient you. You know, and I think it's all part of that. That's the only thing I could think of, keeping him, like, rocked off of on his heels. You know, rock back on his heels.
So just keeping the front going, basically.
Yeah, keeping the pressure on him. Like, you don't know what's happening. You don't know. You know, you shouldn't be going to the island. You shouldn't be leaving it. You're not in your right senses. Like, I heard you accuse, you know, Ade, you know, and you know, you're sketchy as fuck. You know, like, kind of just keeping, like, the pressure on him so he's not asking too many questions about what's really happening to him, you know? I guess that was the only thing I could think of. Did you guys have any other kind of symbolism or meaning behind bringing it up? Because it seemed kind of extraneous otherwise.
Maybe also in the back of his head, he might have been thinking that he had that money. Again, just another tie to the world where he could go back to, and he still had this money, this fortune, if you will, in some small way. That when you even remove that out of the equation, he literally has nothing. You know, there's no connections back. I mean, she essentially has it in her hands. You know, it's like all stripped away. It's small, I admit. But I do feel like it's like the emperor has no clothes suddenly. You know, it's like you're literally standing there naked now. You've got nothing. You don't have even this little bit of money bag. You got nothing.
And why does he roll his money like a drug dealer also? That bothered me from the first episode, at the end of the first episode, when he finds, like, the stash of cash.
Maybe it's what,
like,
they grow in their garden center.
It sounds like people who live in my apartment building for real. they are also doing home gardening and rolling little money stacks. So.
Well, holistic medicine, pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit. Anyway, yeah, it was kind of like a weird thing like that. The phone thing were kind of like head scratchers. But I think this is one of those shows, though, that even when you're said and done, it all has a meaning. You know, I don't think they threw anything in here that they didn't intend to mean something.
We're kind of skimming over some stuff in order to get to, like, the twist, right? But, like, I will throw into, like, what the hell was Larry's biz? Why did he need to drown Sam? Did he want Colonel Sanders to continue to be the leader? And
I think
the leader
there was
only?
A faction that wanted.
Well, let's talk about that for like a second. So that was the plan. Was Nathan, or was to continue along the lineage of Charrington, the current?
I think that was it. I think there was like the element that was okay with the way things were, or like the maybe too scared to see how things would be with somebody else. Maybe that's it. They were fine with keeping Charrington, Colonel Sanders, if you will, on the throne for as long as he could take it. And I think Larry was in on that group.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, okay? Because I really want to understand this. Elder Colonel Sanders there was watching the baptism, right?
Uh-huh.
So does Larry works for him?
Well, he was working in the big house when he dragged Jude down the stairs.
Okay. Right. Mr. Martin hangs with Larry.
Well, they make the sign of the upside down cross to each other.
Okay. I'm just trying to piece it together here just a little bit more, especially for those listening who really haven't pieced it together.
That's what I mean about the...
I think it was all where your faction loyalty lies. They're all about the father. And I think the upside down cross and all of that, like, that is a common bond among... I don't think there's any Oceans that aren't down with the father and the soul of the world, right? So it's just, who do you think is, like, the right one to lead the island? And I think it's really telling when Larry is he acts like a little bitch boy, really. And, you know, when he's tying him up in the spring well area, you know, he's like, you know, you've caused enough, like, division on the island. That's a paraphrase. I can't remember the exact quote. But he's mad at the state of the island, and it's torn over Nathan, over Sam, over Colonel Sanders. You know, he just wants his island to be whole, and I think he's a loyalist to Colonel Sanders. He's obviously in his ploy. And so I think that's what it is. I think he's more angry at the division in the island that he sees Sam as being the cause of. If Sam just got on board, if Sam just came to the island, took his place, and remember, you know, it was his grandfather who left the post. So if you're a Larry loyalist, or maybe even in Colonel Sanders' bloodline somehow, but not in a direct descendant kind of way, to use Lion King, he is a Scar loyalist. He's a hyena, right? They are loyal to Scar, the brother of the rightful king, the uncle to the rightful heir. And so the hyenas were kind of against Simba, right? I know, I'm going deep here on Lion King. to keep your scorecard straight, Sam is Simba in this metaphor, and the little baby born at the end is Nathan. So, yeah, I think it's more just he's mad at Sam. He's putting the blame on Sam because he's an easy target for the division in the island.
What's interesting about that, though, is that the Colonel Sanders, he does seem to want to retire. So
yeah, he can't fucking blow his brains out quick enough. I mean, he's like, thank you. Fucking thank you.
You guys, let's talk about that. That scene really is shocking. You know, the whole, for a show that really did have some grotesque moments. I mean, certainly this third episode was the most grotesque in terms of things like showing the heart and the guts and the squirming, whatever the fuck he was cutting up and all that stuff during the baptism.
Oh, yeah.
You know, parts were high. But that, ooh, you guys, I have like a thing about that. How did you guys feel?
I mean, this was one of the questions I was going to ask you guys at the end. This is the third time now in the last calendar year I have watched someone blow their brains out from underneath their chin on a television show. And I just have to wonder, like, why has this become a trend? It is a disturbing, disturbing image. It was a scene in Evil in its first season. It was a scene in Nosferatu in its current second season, the second season that just ended. Its final season that just ended, sadly. R.I.P. Nosferatu. And now here. Like, it is a very disturbing thing. And it's not like they're cutting away. It's not like they're showing the gun under the chin and then cutting away. In all three examples, you see the fucking thing. You see the blood splatter out of the back of the head, and it's really, really disturbing. And is that the point? It's just to show you what the stakes are, to show you how serious a thing it is? Maybe? I don't know. But I'm not a fan. I am not a fan of the let's watch someone shoot themselves in the head.
Paul has got a pretty iron stomach, so I'm kind of interested in what you think, Paul, because most of the time, you don't ever wince. You don't ever look away. The most horrible, awful thing can be happening to a child, and you're just smiling, watching the show.
Steamed popcorn. Where's my cracker jacks?
I'm crying. I'm a pool on the floor. So what's...
Yeah, you had it coming, you little shit. You had it coming. Take it.
He, like, enjoys it. And so, like, to the point where, admittedly, I will get angry that he's not upset. I'm like, why? Why are you not hurting that this person did this on the screen? And he's like, you're crazy. So I really am curious. Like, does it bother you? Especially, like, I don't know, saying this particular case, did it bother you at all? Or was it just...
It was sufficiently graphic, for sure. Interesting that there was no part of that that included a little cleanup crew of a team there to take care of that.
I noted it too, yeah.
It seemed like, yeah, once that was done, it was like everything was done with him.
Well, he's still laying in the exact same position when the camera eventually pulls away as the swarm happens and the camera goes up in the air. He's still on the dock. I mean, they're all still standing there, but he's still laying there on the dock.
It's the king is dead, long live the king kind of moment, right?
Very much. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But does it wig you out, though, to see like a moment?
As I understand it, if you're going to blow your brains out, the safest way to make sure that you kill yourself is to go like through the mouth, right? Like in the mouth. Cause there's ways that you could miss your face off.
Well, right?
You want to minimize the amount of bone between the bullet and your brain. So through the mouth with a slightly pointed up is the way to do it. Not that we're giving a tutorial on how you should shoot yourself.
Right.
But yeah, if you use the temple, you run the risk of just fucking lobotomizing yourself.
Wasn't there that case too of where someone like you do it, if you do it too far, like on the edge of your chin, you are just like end up shooting off like the front of your face.
Yeah. Right. Cause it's all bone. Right. Correct. Right. Yeah, or cartilage, right. You have like your jawbone and stuff there. And that's a very hard bone, like, you know, to shatter in that kind of way. Not the most efficient, but it's a very dramatic thing to watch though. Watching someone put like gun in their mouth, you can't see the end of the bullet. You don't see the splatter. If you're staring at them through the chin, you see everything. You see the muzzle fire. You see the head jerk back. You see the explosion at the back of the head. You know, so it's just a very visceral kind of thing.
There was, I guess, my single only real, I'll lightly call it a disappointment, but not in any serious way. But just when he swings the gun towards Sam. Was there anybody in the house that thought that he was not about to commit suicide?
Like maybe he's just going to blow Sam away? Well, I mean, wouldn't that have been wild? But it could have happened.
0% chance.
Yeah, I know. But think about that. What if he blew Sam away, took Nathan by the hand, turned and walked up back to the big house?
I could imagine that it was like the director was like shot it both ways. You know, swing it towards Sam or just blow your brains out and let's see what we got. And they went with the swing it towards Sam take, and I'm not here for it because there was just no chance. There's just no chance that he wasn't going to kill himself right then. What did you think, Mike? Were you like, oh my God, he went through all that just to get killed by Colonel Sanders here on the beach?
Yeah, I mean, I've already put it into my tight five Jerry Seinfeld impression set, so for sure. What's the deal with Colonel Sanders and the dog? I mean, no, it didn't surprise me that he killed himself. I you know, and again, just because I think the show, just another nod to the show being so well done, I love the ritual of it, right? You have the Martins who have made up their differences. They know they've got Sam now, right? There is defeat in Sam's face when he gets off of that boat. Jess is the final betrayal, and he has just lost kind of all of the will at that point. He looks like a dead man walking, coming down that pier. And so they're reconciled with each other. They've got the blanket with the gun, and it's all very ritualistic. So I like that because I think that's very keeping in tone with how OC works. These are people who are big on rites and rituals. And so I liked it as a premise, but dear show producers and showrunners, please stop having people shoot themselves in the head. I've seen enough of it now. I'm good. I've seen it three times. I'm good.
It shocks me every time, I admit, from Pulp Fiction on. The blown brains out always makes me jump.
I guess that maybe just for a number of reasons, it needed to be fast. It needed to be final.
And in front of everyone.
Right. And so that's, I mean, instead of just like taking hemlock and wandering off somewhere, they needed it to be like this. And the part where he's just like forgotten there on the beach, that's also interesting, but I think that maybe just be part of that, like a bookended handoff. Like it's completely over. There's no chance of remaining loyalties at this point.
Right. I think like the baptism that began the episode, this was a bookend. This was the end of the ritual. It was a handoff of power. That's why I think they explode into applause. This is a good thing from the islanders' point of view. Power has transferred on the island. The island will calm down now. All the things that Sam is kind of railing about that he doesn't believe about, you know, your oysters will come back again. And what he's yelling, killing Mrs. Martin. Like the islanders believe all of that will happen. And now the rite has finished. Colonel Sanders has taken his life, and now Sam has become the father and is unopposed. It happens on the beach, and the beach is a self-cleaning motif. The idea that blood will not, you know, you kill yourself on the hardwood floor, that blood's always going to be there. Like, you kill yourself on the beach, the sand will take away your, and the water and the ocean will take away your blood. It will cleanse itself, kind of thing. Eventually, his body will take it out to sea. They don't need to remove him. You know, the nature will do that. The island will remove him, kind of thing. So it was all very ritualistic. The applause, which seems, I can see why people may be jarred by that. For these people, it was the end of a necessary transition of power. It's like eventually there will be a new king crowned in England when Queen Elizabeth, you know, passes at some point.
It was very,
you
know, Wizard of Oz, like a wicked old witch is dead, and they proclaim her dead, and all the munchkin goes yay.
Yeah, but only if the idea is that someone is taking her place who is who is worthy to take her place. It would be like the Munchkins, like Glinda dying and Dorothy taking over as Glinda as the next Good Witch and the Munchkins applauding. I think that was the intent of it. I don't think they were happy that Colonel Sanders was dead, per se. I think that they were happy that the power had transferred successfully the way they had seen it. That was kind of how I took it, just because just everything we know about this island, it's all ritual-based, it's all rite-based. So that seemed well in line with it. Going back to one of the things we talked about in the first episode, that whole scene, the whole dock scene, the Martin handing the gun to Colonel Sanders, him thanking him, the spacing, the way they were all spaced, and you had the Islanders well set back where they were almost out of focus. Very play-staged, I felt like, which was something that we didn't really see in episode 2, but this whole end piece, this end set piece, seemed very much like a play to me. I don't know, did you guys pick up on that at all? The way it unfolded hit you guys at all?
No, it didn't. I mean, just I think I can appreciate that. From the beach scene on, I was a little interested as to why that group was like putting like effort into getting a boat out to sea, but then they decide not to. I guess maybe they were thinking that the boat was stuck and they needed to come to them to get Sam. What do you think?
Yeah.
But then like, oh, never mind. She brought it in. So we'll just push the boat back up.
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that what you saw, Mike? You know how there was like that little group and they had like a little rowboat and they were going to kind of rush it to go out to the ocean, but then they didn't go?
Yes. I think that was more of like a stopgap in case, you know, Jess sacrificed her daughters for Sam or whatever, or, you know, turned tail. Let's talk about Jess for a second, though. Was that a big twist for you guys? Was that shock and awe that her daughters that she talked about all the time were on the island? They were the daughters that we were seeing in Colonel Sanders' company everywhere?
It was aggravating because Mrs. Martin said it when she said, "You've seen Nathan all along. You've seen him all around the island." We should have had the full sense to say, "Those daughters are in front of our eyes somewhere, damn it." You know, she's talking about them all the time. No doubt they're right here. What my question was is, it seems like Colonel Sanders could be their father.
I personally don't think that's the case, but I think you could argue for that. When she said that her husband comes from a place like this and there's people that have their eye on her and all that kind of stuff, I got that same sense that I got in Lost when we found out that there was a second hatch. You know, I was like, wait a second, this is much bigger than we were told. I don't know where that's going to lead, if there's like more to the show. It seems more like maybe there's a network of people that believe this stuff in enclaves here and there around the world.
When she says on the boat and Sam is kind of like now learned of this last betrayal, she says, "My husband knows people on the island. They will tell him." That's a very weird way to phrase it if Colonel Sanders is...
Yeah, but what would she say? What would you have said if she can't say that? She can't say my husband's in charge of the whole island.
But the jig was up at that point, though. I mean, he sees the daughters run to her when he gets, you know, when they
Yeah, but she had said that before. She said that before the jig was up.
Well, she's on the boat, though, when she's pulling it, when she's trying to explain to him why she is betraying him, when he realizes, when he turns around. And, you know, she's got the flare gun on him.
Who's her husband? Because I don't know if we don't know him.
Well, she says earlier in an episode that she grew up in a religious community like OC. She knows these people. I agree with, I'm with Paul on this one. I think her husband maybe is a Colonel Sanders at another sect or some other kind of cult-like place.
I don't know, boys. This has been very encapsulated. My point was when Mrs. Martin said, "You've seen the boy, you've seen him around this island," then we should have said we should be able to have seen the daughters. I'm saying we should probably have seen the husband. Is it somebody who like, this show has seemed, there's no outliers.
I think the fact that she's American and that there are cult things happening here.
Do we just trade them amongst the cults? We're like, you send one over here and we'll watch this one.
Well, no, I think she had a role to play in the island. I think they're like, this is a woman who can have influence over Sam at this juncture. So yeah, we're going to take your girls for a little while to keep you in line.
They killed Jason's kid to keep their lie going. So yeah, they'll do an exchange program with your daughters.
I mean, I like the idea that we have either heard of, specifically in another way or seen her husband, but I don't think it was Colonel Sanders. I feel like really, really positive about that. I am less positive that we haven't seen her husband, but the way she referred to him every single time she referred to him made it feel like he was very much not on the island, just very connected to the people of the island.
I like your idea about him possibly being the leader of one of the other sects, because the way that she says, when Sam says, "What does your husband do?" And she goes, "He does nothing," or something to that effect.
Right.
Why couldn't that be Colonel Sanders, who everyone hates and thinks is a pile of shit?
The phrasing just doesn't make any sense. I mean, for a show that was, in the end, pretty honest about how it talked about things, that maybe what seemed like gibberish actually ended up making sense. That just doesn't make sense, even when it plays out. It makes sense that her daughters are there literally as a physical reminder, keeping her in line. You know, why she seems so... kiss him and then run away, and she seems so torn, is because they are physically there reminding her to keep her shit in line, despite everything she may not be feeling. So, spoilers, and if you guys listening don't want to be spoiled, you know, you could skip ahead 25 seconds.
What are we going to spoil them on?
Well, Jess, unlike Jude Law, will be in the next 3 episodes of the season. She will be back for the winter segment when Naomi Harris takes over as the new protagonist and Jude Law is no longer on the show. Jess is still credited for all 6 episodes. So we're not done with Jess. Jess's story is not yet concluded on the island of OC. So it's going to be curious to see how she plays into the next segment of the story.
Very curious.
I have one more thing about Jess, and I'm about to get into some religious stuff from here on out, because for me, that's like the rest of the episode. So you guys just cut my mic off whenever you feel like it. But this episode is called The Ghost, right? We had the Father, we had the Son, and traditionally in the Trinity, we have the Holy Ghost. Here, they just call it The Ghost. So I think we have to give the obvious head nod to that in this episode. But the question is, who is the spiritual ghost in this episode? Is it Nathan? Is it Sam himself? Is it Island? Is it the island, the soul of the world? Is that the spirit, the thing binding them all? I know you guys aren't as religious, like freaks like I am, but I was curious if you guys thought about the title at all.
Just from what you just said, just when we were just talking about the fact that Jess is in like the next parts, I'm actually like a little more looking at her as like, what do you represent? Remember how I kept saying the way that she was like dancing around the fire, her like laying back on the grass? There's like all these moments to me where she has that like funny, freeing spirit part to her that feels like, I don't know. I'm kind of curious about her. We have embodiments of things like Father, Son, and whatever. So, and I love that she said hairy toast. That also made me laugh.
How about you, Paul? Did if thinking about the title of the episode and the way that everything in the show seems kind of deliberate in some way, any thoughts on that?
It's not very original, but I think the island is in itself something. It's not just a landform that goes a little bit above the waterline.
Right.
I think it is something semi-conscious, and leaning toward paranormal, which gives it that ghost-like quality. I can't really put a name to it, and I don't want to borrow from Lost too much because I don't think it's related at all.
It's required bona fides to appreciate the show. I think kind of is. At the beginning, so kind of is. I think you're good. It's part of the syllabus that we handed out at the beginning of the term. So,
well, it can make you see people that aren't there, being alone there. You hear things that may not be there, and it seems to have a will. And the part about it being the soul of the world or whatever, that's remains to be seen how that works. I tend to think this is more like a little terrarium, and the people there somehow nurture the island consciousness, if you will. But I don't know how that, like, maybe that's that network that we're talking about. Maybe all those other little enclaves have their own problems, and if they were all running at 100%, then the world would be hot shit. But they've all got their own version of Colonel Sanders out there.
There are actually quote-unquote souls of the world that people study and think about that relate to spatial geometry. And there's an idea that if you stuck a 3-dimensional cube inside the Earth and unfolded it, so it had 8 axis points, like 8 joints, those places are considered quote-unquote souls of the world. And OC is not one of them, actually. The closest you can get to OC, it is actually in Galicia, which is on the Iberian Peninsula in Spain and Portugal. So the eight souls of the world are the Cocos Islands in Australia, the Corn Islands in Nicaragua, Kalahari Desert in Botswana, the Hawaiian Islands, obviously part of the United States, Tierra del Fuego in Argentina, or Chile, and Lake Baikal in Buryat Republic, and Galicia in Spain, Portugal, and the South Island of New Zealand. Those are the eight quote-unquote souls of the world.
Pretty Mordor. Intriguing that there's so many islands.
Yeah.
Because it could have been anywhere. Could have been smack in the middle of, you know,
of an ocean,
Nebraska.
Right. Well, I mean,
it could have been anywhere.
It makes an interesting story that if you wanted to continue the seasons, that maybe there are other places like this that take the responsibility for being the shepherds. Say what you want about the Oceans. They take their responsibility the way they understand it to the island and their role in keeping it alive and healthy and functioning very seriously. You may not believe what they believe, but I don't think you can take away from them the sincerity and fervence with which they believe it. In a lot of ways, perception is truth. And these people perceive their truth. They are manifesting that this thing is a part of the world and they have an important role in it. That was the thing I kept thinking about and I thought was an interesting thing to stay aware of. It's easy to be like, y'all fucking crazy. But to them, they're not, though. To them, this is very serious business. And there's enough weird shit happening on this island to make you give a little pause. Even your doubters, even your naysayers. I think if you experience OC the way Sam experienced OC these 3 days, I think you have to stop and think, like, is there something going on here a little bit? I like the idea that the ghost is the island. It also occurred to me that the ghost may refer to the line of Charrington, the ghost being like his invisible bloodline that he never even knew existed, connecting him to the island. That was the ghost. It's almost like the ghost of his grandfather that he turns out didn't really know very well.
The supernatural side of that genetic memory.
Yeah, you know, like the ethereal tether of connecting Sam to OC. So third day, we've talked about this a little bit. Third day is a heavy Bible reference. There are a lot of third days or 3 days that occur in the Bible. The most famous one is that Jesus arose from his cave where he was buried after he was crucified. He arose on the third day, what we call Easter Sunday, or what Christians refer to as Easter Sunday is the third day. When Jesus arose in the Gospels, the first person he appeared to after emerging from the cave was Mary Magdalene, his wonderful whore friend that was his bestie. They had a relationship of some sort, depending on who you believe and how much you want to read into the Bible stories. But he appeared to her, and it made me think: is Jess Sam's Mary Magdalene? Is she like this woman of questionable ethics or morality, but also is kind of good for Sam? You know, she betrays him, and Mary Magdalene never betrays Jesus, but she kind of betrays him, but she also seems to have kind of sincere feelings for him. At the end of the day, how much do you believe Jess had feelings for Sam?
I think that's what makes her compelling, is that she does. The question we had earlier about her questioning him about the money and it feeling a little extraneous, but also if she was just trying to figure this guy out, that's the kind of question you'd ask if you gave a shit. If you did give a shit, maybe you don't ask, but I don't know. Maybe she's just very good at selling it. I mean, she is an actress playing a part and all that kind of stuff, but the questions that she asked and the way that she wanted to know more, like perhaps the story and the side of the Nathan abduction that she was told, probably is, you know, her mission briefing. Hearing it from Sam's side was too heartbreaking to just discount, you know, even though she had her own stake in it and the way that she, the ends that she needed to meet, but that still didn't make it less hard for her to go through, and that sort of stuff, you know, builds relationships between people.
I also kind of get this vibe, the way that you're talking about the questions that she asked, that she's almost this like Jiminy Cricket-ish character. Not for the right necessarily, because she certainly lures him into other things. But she is sort of this kind of little character on his shoulder. Sometimes good devil, bad devil kind of business, you know, angel devil, if you will. And she asked the questions I think that we all ask. You know, why do you have this? What is this? What exactly did happen? I feel like that's the role she was playing. I'm trying to really think about how she continues on in the story and where she plays in, especially if she's from some other parish, as y'all are considering. I'm really wondering why she has to continue and like, why would the husband and I...
Is that how it works on for you, Caroline? Do you have a good devil and a bad devil giving you advice?
Oh,
yeah, it's an angel, not a good devil. That's funny. They're both devils. Okay? It's just kind of you know, shades of gray, let's just say.
Yeah, I could justify just about anything. There you go. So good. Say the devils, so say we all.
Hey, it's all shades of gray. Is it really? What is the good devil really? You know, in like a white cloak and the bad.
No,
like
she's in a little white bikini. Yeah, yes, she is.
She's showing some like under boob and just wearing like a crop top.
Exactly. No, yeah, I'm all about good devil, bad devil. I have no interest in being pristine, if that's what you're wondering. Zero. I think it's the most boring way to live. So, niet. But for Jess. And the role that she was playing in this show, in this program that we're discussing, I really do think that she there's something more interesting about her than just considering her like a person, as just a straight up human being. When she says stuff like she was raised in a religious school, why couldn't she be the hairy toast, y'all?
Right. Well, she makes a point of saying whore and slut about herself. So going back to Mike's point, That's a good way to dog ear that page in the viewer's mind, right?
True.
I think her role on the island is the same kind of role that Nathan plays, or the vision of Nathan, and the same kind of role as Epona plays. I think she, not to use the Jiminy Cricket, because we're going to talk about crickets in a bit, but like, yeah, I think she's the guide. I think she is another signpost. I think she is a way of keeping Sam generally on the path that the island is trying to keep him on. The Colonel Sanders jiggered plan is trying to keep him on. I think that's what her role is at the end of the day. So not very Mary Magdalene like, you know, more like a Judas, you know, who was a loyal disciple until
Judas.
Yeah. and you know, in her 30 pieces
Jiminy.
Of silver,
Jesus.
Jesus. It's like the Kanye Jesus. It's Jesus. So yeah, no, I think, you know, instead of 30 pieces of silver, I think she gets her daughters back.
That's 15 per daughter.
Yeah, I mean, which is a going rate on OC. If they were younger, they'd probably get more. According to Goltan anyway. But yeah, no, Judas turns Jesus over to he betrays Jesus because he is afraid that Jesus is going to get them all killed. He is worried about himself and the other apostles, that they're going to come get Jesus one way or another. So by selling him out and telling him where he is in the Garden of Gethsemane, he is protecting himself. And he says that he's protecting the other disciples too, but it's self-preservation. And Jess is acting in the same way. She sells out Sam to preserve her daughters.
That Catholic school really clicked for you, man.
Oh, yeah. I did. After 4 years of Catholic high school, I made a voluntary thing to go to 4 years of Catholic college. If not for boobs, I'd probably be a priest.
Boobs, so, saving lives.
Yeah, saving my chastity. So I don't want to go into the baptism too much. It was super gross. And, you know, I don't think this island is a perfect fit for, like, satanic rituals. I think it's kind of pagan. I think it has a lot of pagan stuff in it. So I don't want to go into the baptism too much. But I do want to ask you whether or not that the third day is the day that Sam is kind of baptized as the father. Is he resurrected? Is this like a Jesus figure? Is he born again into the island father role, sacrificing himself for the good of the island? Because that's why Jesus dies. Jesus dies, you know, to cleanse us of our sins. He is the sacrifice that God demands so that we can all not be perished and blown off the face of the earth, right? God sent his only son. Is Sam the Jesus figure here in a very kind of literal way? I think so. I mean, him coming out of the boat and the baptism, and it's a whole rebirth kind of thing coming out of the water. Yeah, I think he is. I don't know if you guys care or think about the stuff at all, but I was curious if you had any thoughts about it.
No, I can't argue against that. No, I think you're exactly right.
I would like to point out the scene where he does try to run through the water, and I agree wholeheartedly with the idea of any viewer who thought it looked like at some point he was walking on the water, because I do think that that's what it looked like. And he absolutely had that a very Christ-like movement about him that,
yeah,
would absolutely bring that forward.
Yeah, and people forget, like, in his final moments, Jesus was not super cool about the whole having to die thing. He also liked boobs, you know, and he liked Mary's boobs. And in
not Mary's. Mary's is Mary mom.
Magdalene. There's two Marys.
Yeah, Marys, but we don't just Mary say Mary. M. Mary Magdalene is the right one, not Mary's boobs.
I'd say Mary on the half shell if I was talking about his mother. Look up Mary on the Half Shell when you guys get to your Google. It's a very funny thing and happens, at least in New York anyway, it's a thing. I doubt there's very many Mary on the Half Shells in Texas. Anyway, yeah. So, yeah, I he is not cool about, at the end of the day, like, he doesn't want to die. And I think this he doesn't really run like Sam does, but he kind of kicks and struggles against the role that has been set out for him. There's really no free will at the end of the day. And I think for Sam, there's really no free will here at the end of the day. He is on this path, whether he likes it or not.
Just so you know, my grandparents had Mary on the Half Shell right by their driveway.
That's true. That's true. They're in Pennsylvania.
Go.
It's a Northeast thing.
But we don't got to go look it up. God.
Very funny. And you can find Mary Magdalene on a pole inside a half shell. So it's great. For me, the last thing to talk about are the crickets and the darkness that we hear about a lot in this episode. And we had heard a little bit about it before now, but we hear about the darkness is coming a bunch. The crickets. Did you notice the cricket on Larry's forehead on his open wound?
Yes.
Was like, that was disgusting.
Feeding on his blood gross. And wound.
Super gross. It's super gross because crickets represent a lot of things to a lot of cultures. They are a representation of wealth. There are a lot of Asian cultures where crickets are signs of good fortune is coming. Jess is correct when she says that they're a sign of rain is coming. And there's a great scene where he sees the cricket and then it starts to rain for a little bit.
That's the phone scene.
Yeah, that's the phone scene. Right. But they're also a sign of death is coming, which is, you know, not as popular. Not as popular as a read on crickets. So I think it's interesting that there's a lot of cricket imagery in this episode. But at the end, it looks like crickets dropping from the sky when he hugs Nathan, right? And then they go inside the big house and then the crickets, you know, start falling from the sky. And then it intensifies and the camera starts to pull back and, you know, a literal darkness comes. A swarm comes. Here's the problem. Crickets don't swarm.
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. Yeah.
Locust swarm, and locusts and crickets are in the same family. They are the same family. So I don't think that's unintentional. One of the Bible plagues, right? One of the 10 plagues of the Bible is a swarm of locusts that blot out the sky, that eat, that destroy all that's left. You know, I will send a plague of locusts. They will destroy your crops. They will make life unbearable for you. And then they do. And the swarm comes. And that swarm kind of creates darkness on the island. I think that's the final image of, as the camera pulls back at the end of this episode, right? Is it has become so dark from the swarm being so thick. So it's interesting that they're playing with cricket imagery all three episodes, but then it's kind of locusts at the end, like a literal darkness plague brought on by locusts, you know, at the end of the episode. What did you guys think of the crickets? All said and done, what role did crickets play in the third day for you?
I'm not ready to say all the roles, but I am wanting to say that I really liked the cinematography of having the bugs actually smack into the camera, making that like
tink, 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 blink.
I really liked that. My only gripe about it was I wanted them to do it until it cracked the glass, and then I wanted it to go dark, like as if they were making it through our TV. That was the only thing I wanted. But I really, really liked that.
The last image did seem to be of the insects not only blotting out the sky, but eating stuff up too.
Right.
Which made me think of the, the last Knights Templar in the last crusade. He says, you chose poorly. Makes me wonder if Sam was the bad choice after all.
Or if they're hitting reset. Well, here's the thing. So Mimir says when Sam wakes up after the baptism, he says the island needs a father to shepherd them through the darkness. So I think the darkness is coming one way or another. The idea is that you need a strong father to keep the island together through that period. So it's not, I didn't write down the quote, but he says, but essentially it was, a father is needed to guide OC through the darkness. And so that's why this rite had to happen now. You know, the ritual had to be concluded now. Colonel Sanders had to, his tenure needed to end now, because the darkness wasn't just fucking coming. You know, it was here. Winter had come. It wasn't just coming. If winter was now here, the darkness was now here, literally at the very last, so I think the transfer of power literally happened at the very last second it possibly could have, if you buy into the island's theory of the darkness is coming and we need a father to get us through it. Just a little quote from Exodus. I will bring locusts into your country tomorrow. They will cover the face of the ground so that it cannot be seen. They will devour what little you have left after the hail, including every tree that is growing in your fields. They will fill your houses and those of all your officials and all the Egyptians, something neither your fathers nor your forefathers have ever seen from the day they settled in this land until now. From Exodus 10, verses chapter 10, verses 3 through 6. Yeah, it's like the eighth plague. It's a big one.
That's just a standard Hebrew farewell, right?
Yeah, no, locust!
Right. Thanks for dinner.
My biggest curiosity about the crickets, just generally speaking, was that when Sam points out the fact that there were paper ones. So some were real, but some were fake. And that was fascinating because it really made me wonder how much of everything is real in this situation and how much is any of it being just a false facade here.
Is it a false facade for Sam's sake, or is it like a celebration of the cricket? Like people are making, you know, like on Chinese New Year, there are, you know, dragons, costumes made to,
but it didn't
to kind
feel
of
celebratory.
Celebrate that.
Did it feel celebratory?
Not the one that Sam picked up. I mean, no, it didn't. It didn't.
So I wonder what that's about, because it's almost like making something into a bigger thing than it actually is.
Do you think that the cricket whose carcass that Sam kicks over in the first episode that was full of the baby insects, do you think that was the kind of the foreshadowing of the coming darkness?
Yes, I do. I think the islanders were sensing all of the signs of the darkness coming, and there's no way we could have known that, no way Sam could have known that, but I think the sea kind of drying up, which seemed to be more of a recent thing-ish. I think there were signs of the darkness coming.
Well, and they kept saying the dark is in you in various ways, right?
Well, that too, yeah.
So it's sort of like he's the key in the ignition.
And I'm still going back to that whole Nathan may not be a good seed. What does it mean, you guys? Is it a good devil, bad devil situation?
Right. Well, maybe to be the father, the shepherd OC through the darkness, maybe to be a good father, an effective father, capital F, you need to have a little bit of that darkness in you. You need a little bit, you know, listen.
As Logan would say, Logan Roy would say, you got to be a killer.
Right. Maybe so.
Like him or don't like him, the Emperor and all of the Sith Lords were powerful as fuck. I mean, they could do shit that regular good light Jedi could not do. The dark side of the Force was extremely powerful.
Quicker, you
know,
easier.
They could Force choke. You know, that wasn't something that, you know, light side of the Force people, I mean, I guess technically they could have, but they would have had to engage in dark side rituals to do that. Yeah, I mean, there's a power in the dark side because of the... But it always makes sense, though, right? There's a power to dark side of things, but to access them, you have to... There's a cost, right? There is a spiritual cost, if not a physical or emotional cost, to engaging in those things. And so maybe to be a good father, you have to be willing to access those dark sides. You have to be willing to pay the cost to do that. And not everyone is capable or willing to. You know, someone of good Charrington stock, though, you know, presumably is. I think it's interesting. So just because the Exodus story is a great one in the Bible, the idea is Moses goes to Pharaoh and is like, listen, you got to let my people go. The chosen people, God's chosen people, the Jewish people, the Israelites. And Pharaoh's like, no, they're building my pyramids. You know, fuck you. We're keeping them. And so Moses is like, dude, God's not going to be happy. So he goes, there's this whole song and dance, right? All through Exodus. It's like, listen, I'm going to do this thing. 10 things come to pass, right? The eighth one are the locusts. Do you know what? Take a guess what the ninth plague was. No cheating. Take a guess what followed.
Spiders, spiders coming out of your belly?
Spider beetles? No, it was not spider beetles. It was not spider beetles. The ninth plague. Nope. The ninth plague.
Hold on. Paul didn't even get a guess. Paul, right, what's your guess?
I'll go with raining fire.
No, there was raining frogs that happened earlier. Oh. That was one of the lesser plagues.
Paul, frogs, not fire.
Shit.
Maybe they were fire frogs. The ninth plague, following a swarm of locusts that blot out the sky, was darkness descended upon Egypt. That was the ninth plague. Do you know how long the darkness lasted?
Until fall.
Through fall into winter.
It lasted for 3 days.
What?
Mic drop. I just took my mic off the stand and I kicked it to the floor. I'm out, bitches. That's what I'm leaving with. The darkness plague lasted for 3 days. It all makes sense. It's just a Bible story.
Well, what was number 10?
10 is the Passover. 10 is when God was like, fucker, all right, you done pissed me off, and God smites the firstborn of all the Egyptians. That is where the high holy day of Passover comes from.
Okay, but hold on. Let's apply it to our story, since that's what we're doing. So since we're talking locusts, and in the next 3 days should be that, then the last three... Perhaps Sam's firstborn?
Well, okay, so here is the story. Moses tells all of the Israelites, listen, go slaughter a lamb or a goat. Put the blood, smear it over your door. All right, when the angel of death comes through town later tonight, it will pass over all of the houses that have this blood sigil outside. If you don't have that blood sigil outside, angel of death is going to come in and it's going to kill your firstborn. I believe it's firstborn male. But let's just say firstborn for purposes of this story. And in the morning, when the sun rose, there was anguish and cries throughout the land, including Pharaoh's own son was killed by the angel of death. And at that point, Pharaoh's like, get the fuck out! I'm done! Get out! But then he has to change of heart, and he chases the Israelites all the way across, you know, the river until he's washed out. So, across the Red Sea. Anyway, so if you there maybe is some kind of mass death going if we're going to continue going on the plagues tour.
I think we have to go on the plagues tour, don't we? I don't think it's optional.
Well, this brings me to my last question for you. What do you think is going to happen in this 12-hour autumn season live theatrical event that will be happening in a week?
Personally, I think Sam is not going to be very eager to fulfill his role as father of the island, and he's going to be trying to find a way to get off with Nathan. Yeah, I don't think he's going to be like, give me the keys. I'm going to shake some things up. I was kidding with Caroline. That like, first thing we're doing is a lot of fucking layoffs for sure. Everyone. Larry, you're out.
Right.
Pack your shit.
No more neck tattoos for you, Larry.
Right. Mr. and Mrs. Martin, yeah, your pub owning days are over. But yeah, other than still rebelling against his lot in life, I don't know how they're going to make 12 hours of that.
I think it's going to be the festival.
You think it's the festival?
Yeah, it is the festival.
I think it's the festival.
So I don't think it's set spoilers to say in the articles that have been released about it. It's supposed to follow the festival that we've heard about, the Isis in the Sea festival, will play out over the 12-hour period. And Jude Law has said that there is a rite or ritual that has to be completed before the end of the 12-hour period. But exactly how it happens and how it plays out will be kind of... he didn't go so far as to say improv'd, but it is a little bit unpredictable how it will happen. It just will happen by the end of the thing.
Right. It's like unscripted, but certain things have to happen at certain points.
Right. There are milestones they have to get to and hit as the story progresses over the 12 hours.
I think it's pretty fascinating. I think it's a cool way to try to do something new and different. And I mean, I'm sure when they planned this, it wasn't, you know, Rona times weren't in their minds. And this is really kind of a cool way for people who are sitting around on October 3rd.
I believe that's right.
On the 3rd.
Third
day. Shit, that's y'all. Fucking A.
Third day.
Fucking A.
Interesting that, I mean, they're moving the normal air date of the show to make it on the 3rd, 10-3rd, which is autumn time, which makes sense. It's the autumn period. We are in the autumn period. I don't know what OC looks like in the fall, but at least, I mean, they're being accurate to the calendar.
Now, there is a full moon ritual, y'all. Just letting you know.
We don't want anybody out there to start their own religion based on this show, I don't think. It seems.
But you could call me or email me if you are interested in tips.
Yeah, Mike has a blueprint if you want. I don't recommend it. You know, I'd go with Star Wars. If you're looking for entertainment-based religions, go with the Force. But, yeah, I mean, Mike could help you set some things up if you'd like an OC-based religion.
I have like a startup guide. I have a couple templates you could use. I have a cloak that I rent.
There's that webinar that you charge for. I've heard you pitch
maybe
that
before. Maybe that's part of the Patreon for Podclubhouse is you can join the religious podcast with Mike.
Yes.
You're going to tell people how to do all kinds of rituals.
It's behind the paywall because we're that kind of podcast company.
Hey, we don't want people stumbling upon it. If you pay for it, you mean to get involved.
Exactly. Right.
Okay.
That is true. Caroline, taking bets. Does Sam make it out alive after the 12-hour autumn festival?
Oh, boy. I'm going to say no. I don't think so. You've already said he wasn't in the last three, so...
Right, but that doesn't mean he's dead. It could be he leaves the island or something like that.
And IMDb lies.
Oh, IMDb lies?
Yeah, they'll be in cahoots with production companies and channels and things.
Hold up.
Well,
cahoots?
Yeah. You've seen it before where a show will supposedly kill a character and then even like their names are taken off the main credits and then like IMDb will say something like, you know, only in for so many episodes, but then later when they come back, they correct. And I don't know if it's lying or so much as it's...
A little secret. Production companies actually submit that information to IMDb. So it's actually the production companies that are keeping those people off of the rolls. I think IMDb is just a repository. I don't know how much actual fact-checking they actually do.
Repository!
So to answer your question, I think...
I don't want him to die. I don't feel like he needs to die.
Yeah, but it makes sense if he does.
It does.
Because I think the point of trying to convince a man who was not brought up on the island to be the father of the island, even though they've gone through the initial rite, to go with your Catholic terminology, I don't think he's been confirmed just yet. And I think that's what maybe the 12 hours builds up to, and he just won't do it.
I am of kind of the same mind. I think there's going to be some kind of reckoning where they can't have two possible fathers on the island. The fact that Nathan is there and that Sam is there is going to cause some kind of issue. And or the choice is going to come down to, like, Sam will have to sacrifice himself so that Nathan can live, even if it means Nathan has to become the father. I think it's going to end in some kind of ritualistic thing. Maybe not exactly like how Colonel Sanders did himself in. But it's going to come. My feeling is that it's going to come down to some kind of ritualistic sacrifice on Sam's part so that Nathan can live.
Oof. That's going to be wicked to watch, man.
Yeah, definitely pour yourself a stiff drink.
12 hours of watching to see. But I think it's going to be exciting. And I'm happy that they're trying to do something different. I always enjoy when the showrunners take a risk and try to do something that's exciting for us to watch.
Yeah, well, listen, hit
it's
or miss.
It's titillating.
We know how I feel about the titillating. Hit or miss, you have to give the show a tremendous amount of credit, not only for the kind of avant-garde storytelling that they've done so far, but just the fact that they're attempting this. The fact that they're attempting this in the Rona times, even if they've had to change their plans around. You know, the amount of production work that has had to go into this. I think Jude Law has been working on this with the show's like producers and creators for like almost a year at this point for this event. That's a tremendous amount of work, and I give them so much credit for taking the big swing.
I have no idea how I'm going to watch 12 hours of internet coverage of the festival.
I really hope that there is some way to record it or to watch it recorded after the fact so that we can see it again.
You get yourself a big brick of cocaine. That's step one. Step two is you get a big straw.
Oh, my God. Paul's like, you lost me at...
Right.
Brick of cocaine? Don't worry. Also behind the paywall is how you can get your big bricks of cocaine.
Yeah, and a pee tub.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Not if you wear diapers because you have loose bowels.
Mike's TV diapers.
Loose
now.
Stools.
Right. Now with loose stool insulation.
souls.
No softeners needed.
So gross. Oh, anyway. My God.
Thank you guys for listening to the Third Day podcast. I hope you continue to join us for our coverage of autumn and then winter. And we'll be back in a week to tell you what we thought about the 12-hour extravaganza.
So excited to see this and hope that it's going to be like goes off without a hitch because like live TV, y'all. Live TV. You almost have to watch just for that, no?
It's usually entertaining when they do it, but I've only ever seen it like ER did it and like 30 Rock did it. And those all went off without a hitch, except for a little bit of like cracking up a little bit on 30 Rock. But this is 12 hours. This is a totally
there
different thing.
There could be
thing.
Like nip slips and like all kinds of shit that goes on. I think it could be fun.
I mean, when I watch it frame by frame for the nip slips, it's going to take me seven times as long to watch the whole thing. So.
Oh my God. Well, this is going to be fun. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed listening to us and hope to see you guys next week.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening.
This is Caroline.
This is Paul.
This is Mike.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.
Pod Clubhouse.